The headlines: G7 leaders promise to strengthen Ukraine's air defense amid continued Russian airstrikes. The U.S., South Korea, and Japan pledge to keep all options open against North Korea, including counterstrikes. And in a few weeks' time, Venezuela will be reopening its border with Colombia. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The group of seven major economies vowed to keep supporting Ukraine by pumping up more weapons to the country. The G7 members say they will shore up Ukraine's air defense and continue to help Kiev meet its urgent requirements for military equipment. The bloc includes Britain and the U.S., which have been the biggest providers of military aid to Ukraine since the start of its war with Russia in February. The G7 made a pledge after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky appealed for more military assistance to the country.
Ukraine needs modern tanks. I ask you to make this defensive weapon to us. It is possible to do it now. Ukraine needs stable supportive artillery with howitzers and rockets in order to prevent escalation from the Russian side. We need more response artillery and long-range rockets. The more effective we are with these weapons, the shorter the Russian aggression will be.
Zelensky also called on the G7 to provide Ukraine with an additional 2 billion cubic meters of natural gas to help the country cope with its energy shortages. This comes as Ukrainians are struggling to keep warm during winter and face power cuts amid Russian airstrikes on critical infrastructure. More news from Ukraine. The country says that the world should reconsider the issue of nuclear security amid what Kiev calls Russian attacks against Europe's largest nuclear power plant.
It changed everything. I think that's a very important issue. That's all the world should rethink what is nuclear safety now and how we could respond. We just cannot look at this, what is happening, and say, yes, it's bad, or look what is happening. So we need to respond to this. And the response could be, first, we should do something with the Russians, that's for sure. They break everything that was built before.
The minister also warned that Russian missiles with a range of 2,000 kilometers are a threat, as they could reach any nuclear reactor in Europe. Ukraine accuses Russia of targeting Zaporizhzhia power plant, which has been under Russian control since March. Kiev says the site has been cut off Ukraine's energy grid several times due to Russian shelling. The Kremlin has pushed back against the allegations. It says Ukraine has committed nuclear terrorism by launching attacks on the nuclear power plant. The UN nuclear watchdog has also raised alarm over the safety of the plant. Still in Europe, thousands of rail workers are on strike across the UK amid a backlash over economic pressure across different sectors. Britain's largest rail union, RMT, has called the industrial action. The strikers are expected to organize picket lines at major train stations. The action is expected to trigger massive transport disruptions during the Christmas travel peak. Britain has been witnessing back-to-back strikes over the past months. Those include work stoppage by postal workers and border officers. Britain is facing a rising inflation and surging energy prices that came on the heels of Western sanctions over the war in Ukraine. Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, the U.S., Japan, and South Korea are going to impose more sanctions on North Korea to counter what they call Pyongyang's nuclear threat.
Based on the robust ROK-U.S. alliance and the trilateral security cooperation, we will strengthen our deterrence against North Korea's nuclear and missile threat. We will coordinate sanctions and close gaps in the international sanctions regime.
The official also accused Pyongyang of becoming more aggressive and blatant in its threats. He made the comments in a meeting with his U.S. and Japanese counterparts in Jakarta. The U.S. representative also described North Korea's behavior as one of the most serious security challenges to the region and beyond. Meanwhile, the Japanese envoy said the trio would examine all options, including counterstrike capabilities. The sanctions follow the test of an intercontinental ballistic missile by North Korea last month. Pyongyang has fired over 60 missiles, including 8 ICBMs, this year in response to U.S. hostilities. The North says that its missile program is for self-defense. To discuss that further, we're joined by Jennifer Cheng, our correspondent, who's joining us from Seoul, and also Andrew Leung, independent China specialist, joining us from Hong Kong. Let's begin with our correspondent, Jennifer. How effective is the threat of sanctions? Will more sanctions be enough to stop North Korea from going ahead with its plans?
Well, the U.S. claims that these new sanctions will work. They are working with their allies, Japan and South Korea, in addition to their EU allies, to try to sanction North Korea even more than the sanctions placed on the North in the past through U.S.-led UN sanctions, for instance. But the U.S. failed to get UN sanctions support in the UN Security Council because that was vetoed by China and Russia, who claimed that the U.S. is at fault for all the aggression, the missile testing. The North fired over 60 missiles this year alone, and over 30 since last September of this year. So we're talking late September to December. That's not even 3 months, and they already fired more than 30 missiles, plus they fired 8 ICBMs. Their biggest ICBM test took place on November 18th. It was a big success, and this is why there's this flurry of activity by the U.S., South Korea, and Japan to try to sanction the North, and especially they would like to cut off the financial means by which the North gets money to fund its nuclear and ballistic missile programs. The North, due to all these sanctions, has been forced to rely on cyber crime, and they say that they are going to crack down somehow on this hacking, this cyber crime. But so far, the allies have not been able to do that, so it doesn't look too promising. There's very little they can do if the North does indeed carry out a 7th nuclear test, which the U.S. has been warning about along with South Korea for months now. They have said that since May, the North has been ready to fire off a nuclear test at any time, and it's just a political decision at this point as to when that test would take place. Of course, the last time the North did a nuclear test was in 2017, so this would be a big milestone. This has been a long time that the North has been waiting to see if nuclear negotiations with the U.S. would work, but they didn't work under the previous Trump administration. And now it looks like the North will indeed resume its nuclear testing. It's just a matter of when, and the U.S. and the U.S.'s allies can do little to stop the North from bargaining at the negotiation table after they conduct a nuclear test. So the U.S. and their allies are deeply worried indeed.
Okay, so Mr. Leung, we are hearing about this alliance of three countries, North Korea, with all of its options, including counterstrikes. What would be a probable counterstrike? How would it look like, and how serious could that be?
I think that we have heard the same kind of story before. with the so-called six-party talks and all the years of, spent in trying to negotiate with North Korea without displaying a genuine desire for a one-on-one genuine negotiation. All these negotiations for the North Koreans all turn out to be coercion, asking the North Korea, North Koreans to give up their defense. And I think Kim Jong-un is now totally fed up with all this and is now trying to build his own defense capabilities against the world's largest hegemon, which is the United States, along with its allies. And I think it's also trying to take a leaf out of Chairman Mao's book in the early beginning. Don't forget, at that time, Chairman Mao was threatened by nuclear forces. At that time, China was at loggerheads with Russia and was threatened by nuclear coercion by Western countries. And Chairman Mao at that time, China was extremely poor, but China chose to develop the bomb instead of developing the economy. And the same kind of story is now what's going on in North Korea. And also, this also shows that it seems the West, led by the United States, is running out of toolkits, and there's only one a tool in their toolbox, which is military coercion. And they've forgotten their experience with, for example, North Vietnam. I mean, the Vietnam War ended not because of American invaded Vietnam, but because of the economy, because the American helped Vietnam to grow its economy. And now Vietnam has become almost an American ally. And I think the United States has failed to learn the lessons and still trying to use military coercion. And the same applies to all their policies against China, against Russia. It's always the military, but because this is, seems to be the only one one tool in the toolbox. And I think that this single-minded fixation on a military fails in most circumstances.
Okay, so Jennifer, you mentioned several times, and we've talked previously several times about this particular issue, the U.S. and South Korea have been conducting these massive military drills with the alleged purpose of deterring a war. But isn't this militarism actually giving North Korea what it needs to justify a weapons test?
Yes, it is. Many experts are saying that these military drills provoked North Korea into conducting so many missile tests this year. And the U.S. and South Korea are refusing to back down. They just keep doing more and more military drills, while Pyongyang also refuses to back down. They keep firing artillery shells into an area near the inner Korean sea border that the North and South Koreas agreed not to fire artillery shells into during their 2018 summit in Pyongyang. So this is really raising tensions on the Korean Peninsula. Of course, the North Koreans also fired a mid-range missile over Japan this year, and they fired an ICBM capable of hitting the U.S. mainland. So they have shown that they can hit not only the U.S., but U.S. bases in Guam, which would be responsible for nuking North Korea in the event of an accidental war breaking out here on the Korean Peninsula, not to mention Japan, where half the U.S. forces in charge of defending South Korea are stationed. Of course, the other half are here in South Korea. North Korea has shown that it is developing tactical nukes capable of nuking all those troops here in South Korea and getting past all the U.S. missile defenses, the THAAD Patriot system stationed here in South Korea. So no longer does the U.S. and its allies have any kind of a military advantage over North Korea. Now it's the North that has the advantage with all its nuclear weapons and its missiles and projectiles and a wide range of sophisticated weapons.
Thank you very much, Andrew Leong, independent China specialist from Hong Kong, and our very own Jennifer Chang from Seoul. Thanks for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review. Venezuela says that it will fully reopen its land border with Colombia within weeks after a thaw in ties between the two neighbors.
I can announce that we will be completely opening the entire western border of Venezuela with Colombia for the passage of vehicles.
The Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro underlined that Caracas is committed to the pledges that it made during the recent talks with Bogota. The border between the two countries partially reopened in October after 7 years of closure. Diplomatic relations between the two countries broke off in 2019 after former Colombian government questioned Maduro's election victory. Colombia's new president, Gustavo Petro, has taken steps to mend ties with Venezuela since taking office in June. The two neighbors formally re-established diplomatic relations in August. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Role of Erdogan power's policies and recent bitter events in Iran is obvious. This is the part of speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. This ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Officer and Police Training. If we look at your presence here, those who have gathered in the Imam Hassan Mushtaba University of Officer and Police Training, and also those who are hearing this speech in other universities, your presence and entry into the armed forces is a great asset. Your presence is a great asset, of course, when it is alongside the experience of our veterans and the knowledge of the commanders. Strengthening the armed forces means strengthening the country. The armed forces are one of the strong pillars that strengthen the country. Of course, strengthening the country does not just depend on the armed forces. There are also other strong pillars.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Scientific advancements are a source for the country's progress. The general faith of the people and the penetration of faith into people's hearts is a source of national strength. a government that has been built by the people and relies on the people is a source of national pride for any country. All of these things exist, but the presence of the armed forces and military strength are also important means to strengthen the country's foundation. All these various factors are able to maintain and protect the country from harmful, hostile actions. Of course, this is true for all countries and is not just limited to ours. All countries need these things to preserve their stability, but it is even more imperative in a country like ours, which is faced with aggressive enemies such as the US and other similar countries. Therefore, our defensive power needs to be strengthened. I've always said this, and I will repeat it again. Our defense needs to be strengthened. A part of it needs to be strengthened from outside the armed forces, and a part of it from inside the armed forces. I shall talk about the latter. The officials in the armed forces need to look at new, updated ways to enhance the strength of the armed forces. These include optimizing education and military equipment, which thankfully is something that has been initiated in our armed forces. However, more work needs to be done in this regard today.
You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United States is pressing the UN not to update a blacklist of companies doing business in illegal Israeli settlements. The US has said things like it opposes any work to update it, or our view is that this database only serves to reinforce an anti-Israel bias that too often finds traction in UN venues. It also said that this database poses a genuine threat to companies doing business or considering business operations in the region. Yet the U.S. statements lack any concern about how these settlements are illegal in the first place. The U.N. Human Rights Office published a list back in the year 2020. It was a database of more than 100 companies that it said are doing business in Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. The database took more than 3 years to complete. It was hailed by campaign groups as a significant step forward in making sure that big business respected international law. The overwhelming majority of the 112 firms named on the database were Israeli, including many of the country's main banks. But the list also included a number of well-known international companies, including, among others, Motorola Solutions, General Mills, TripAdvisor, and Airbnb of the U.S., Apodo, and J.C. Bamford of the United Kingdom, and Alstom of France. Israel's largest banks provide services that help support, maintain, and expand unlawful settlements by financing their construction in the occupied West Bank, including partnering with developers to build structures on land unlawfully seized from Palestinians. A 41-page report called Bankrolling Abuse, Israeli Banks in West Bank Settlements, detailed the scope of banking activities in settlements and the violations to which these activities contributed. Israel's seven largest banks provided services to the settlements. But funding for illegal settlements took the form of donations, like from the U.S. In the year 2015, an investigation into private U.S. funding of settlements revealed a network of tax-exempt charities that funneled hundreds of millions of dollars to Jewish communities in the West Bank. The money was transferred from New York, Miami, Texas, ending up in Hebron or the Old City of Jerusalem, and all came from organizations for which donations were tax-deductible in the U.S. Israel is already suffering from the BDS movements, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which works to end international support for Israel's oppression of Palestinians and to pressure Israel to comply with international law. One of the issues that BDS exposes are products that are made in settlements and sold outside of Israel. BDS says the purchase of these products contributes to the Israeli regime and companies operating in occupied Palestinian lands. Israel has built more than 100 settlements in territories it captured from Jordan during a war in 1967. Under international law, the settlements in both the West Bank and Al-Quds, which are home to more than 600,000 people, are considered illegal, although Israel and the U.S. dispute such a characterization. They contribute to a discriminatory regime in which Israeli authorities restrict and stunt Palestinian economic development while subsidizing and supporting Israeli settlements built on land unlawfully seized from Palestinians. International humanitarian law forbids an occupying power from using land except for military purposes for the benefit of the local population living under occupation. Even though the U.S. opposes illegal settlements, its actions by all means support Israel and falls way short of taking any action to stop it. And now, with an extreme far-right administration that the incoming Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is forming, settlement building may move at an accelerated pace.
For me, the results of the last elections from last week is no less than a revolution in the national sense and in my personal life, because I've been yearning for a moment when the powers that are for the great Israel and for Jewish values, that these political powers will be in government.
The new Israeli administration, headed by Benjamin Netanyahu and National Security Minister Ben Gvir, have agreed to legalize settlements. They announced that they will move ahead and amend what's called the disengagement law in order to enable settlers to settle in the northern occupied West Bank. It would legalize dozens of illegal West Bank outposts, something known as young settlements. All of this spells bad news for Palestinians who are fighting for their land.
President Xi hails a new era of relationships with the Persian Gulf state during his meeting with King Salman in his three-day stay at Yamama Palace in Saudi Arabia. The world's largest exporter of crude oil, joined by the world's largest importer of it, signed a comprehensive strategic partnership agreement that involved the Chinese tech giant Huawei. Huawei is one of the companies that just recently was barred from exporting its equipment to the U.S. because of a recent imports ban in the U.S. on certain high-profile Chinese tech firms, including the likes of ZTE and Hikvision. While this was the most restrictive ban, it is not an isolated ruling. Anti-Chinese rhetoric became mainstream during Donald Trump's presidency when he banned all of Huawei's 5G equipment from the U.S. and even by extension in some EU countries. He also banned U.S. citizens from owning Xiaomi stocks, labeling the company as a communist Chinese military company. Despite the U.S. security officials warning that equipment from Chinese brands such as Huawei in the field of telecommunications can be used to collect sensitive information, most of the 5G infrastructure in the Persian Gulf states is built, at least with the partial assistance from Huawei. With all the hassle that the U.S. has been causing these Chinese businesses, it was only a matter of time before they looked elsewhere to grow their business, as relationships between the U.S. and China are shaky at best. Now Saudi Arabia has become an important destination to grow these brands. But on the other side, Saudi Arabia's relationships with the U.S. is also at a low point, and King Salman's meeting with Xi Jinping solidifies the signal that was already being sent that Saudi Arabia is inching away from the U.S. This is becoming more and more apparent over the disagreements between the two countries over energy policies, security guarantees, and human rights issues. The U.S. isn't making inflammatory comments about the visit, but the coordinator for strategic communications of U.S. National Security Council, John Kirby, did say that, quote, "We're mindful of the influence that China is trying to grow around the world." Saudi Arabia's energy minister said that the relationship between the two countries is witnessing an epoch-making milestone, as he vowed that the kingdom will remain China's credible and reliable partner when it comes to oil production. Saudi Arabia isn't the only country warming up to China and even Russia, as the OPEC Plus decision to cut down on oil production amid rising demands from the West and especially the U.S. was a joint decision between the kingdom and Russia as the leaders of the major oil exporting organization. While Saudi Arabia sees the U.S. as its top security partner, the recent shakeup in their relationships, especially as a result of that very same OPEC Plus decision, has prompted the oil-rich kingdom to diversify on its partners list. It has shown that it does not want to hurt its relationship with Russia, as they have significant shared interests as leaders of the most influential crude oil exporting organization, and now it is showing that it is not shying away from cozying up to the U.S.'s trade war rival, China. As the use of Chinese yuan in the China-Saudi oil settlements is becoming increasingly more likely, especially during President Xi's visit to the kingdom, there is also the possibility of Saudi Arabia joining BRICS, as interest has been shown by the kingdom to join the trade-centered organization that also includes Russia as a member state. If, in fact, Saudi Arabia agrees to receive the Chinese yuan in exchange for its oil, that will be considered a massive blow to the falling hegemony of the U.S. dollar in world trade, and especially in oil. This de-dollarization effort has been accelerating, and the first major instance of it happened as Western sanctions first started pouring in on Russia to limit its trade potential. What ended up happening was that as China's oil imports from Russia went up, state-owned oil enterprises increasingly used the Chinese yuan as payments. While all European Union member states are one way or another forced to cooperate with the U.S. in sanctioning Russia, even if at an extremely high cost, the rest of the world is seeing less and less of an obligation to bend down to the will of the once hegemonic superpower as they see the prospect of a multipolar world more and more plausible and desirable.
A group of Australian lawmakers arrived in Taiwan despite warnings from Beijing over the visit at a time of rising tensions over the self-ruled island.
There's a group of bipartisan members of the parliament from Australia currently visiting Taiwan. They are already here. We appreciate that the Australian parliament is very friendly to Taiwan.
Taipei's foreign ministry stated that the members of the delegation will meet the territory's president and other officials during their five-day visit. The ministry added the meetings will focus on a wide array of issues of mutual interest. The Chinese foreign ministry expressed opposition to the trip, calling on Canberra to respect the One China principle.
Taiwan is an inalienable part of Chinese territory. The One China policy is a recognized norm of international relations, and it is also the prerequisite and political basis for China to develop friendly relations with other countries. The Australian side should earnestly abide by the One China policy, stop any form of official exchanges with the Taiwan region.
Under the One China policy, Beijing considers Taiwan a breakaway province that should be reunited with the mainland. The spokesperson also warned Australia against official exchanges with Taiwan, calling on Canberra to stop sending wrong signals to separatist forces in Taiwan. The visit to Taiwan comes as Australia's recently elected Labour government has moved to repair its strained diplomatic relations with China. Last month, Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese met China's President Xi Jinping at the G20 summit in Bali, Indonesia. But the parliamentary trip to Taiwan would cast a shadow on attempts to build ties between Beijing and Canberra. Albanese sought to play down the mission's significance after it was first reported. He insisted the visit was separate from government business, saying there have been backbench visits to Taiwan for a long time. Australia had long maintained it didn't have to choose between China and the U.S., but in recent years, its attitude toward Beijing has revealed where it stands in the world. Signing the AUKUS Security Pact with the U.S. and U.K. and rotational presence of American forces in Australia are a testament to Canberra taking the side of the U.S. over China. The Pentagon has announced that the United States will increase the rotational presence of its forces in Australia.
Today, we agreed to deepen our defense cooperation in several important ways, including enhancing our force posture cooperation. And based upon today's talks, we will increase rotational presence of U.S. forces in Australia. That includes rotations of bomber task forces, fighters, and future rotations of U.S. Navy and U.S. Army capabilities.
The United States and Australia agreed to deepen their military ties, citing shared concerns over China's actions around Taiwan.
What we want is a region that is stable, prosperous, and respectful of sovereignty. And as we've made clear many times, U.S. engagement in the Indo-Pacific makes an indispensable contribution to such a region.
The two allies made the announcement following annual high-level talks between the top U.S. and Australian defense and diplomatic officials. The two countries have also agreed to invite Japan to boost its military cooperation. Washington sees Canberra as a vital partner in its effort to push back against China in the Indo-Pacific, and analysts say Australia could have a crucial logistical role to play in the defense of Taiwan against any move by Beijing. Australia's Northern Territory is already host to frequent military collaborations with the United States. Thousands of U.S. Marines rotate through the territory annually for training and joint exercises, started under former President Barack Obama. The United States is also planning to deploy up to 6 nuclear-capable B-52 bombers to an airbase in northern Australia, amid heightened tensions with China. Canberra has moved to bolster relations in the Pacific amid growing Chinese influence, including a security pact between China and Solomon Islands in April. In September, the United States, United Kingdom, and Australia marked the one-year anniversary of the AUKUS Security Pact. They then announced that they have made significant progress towards Australia acquiring nuclear-powered submarines.
Israeli forces have shot dead 3 Palestinians during a raid on the Jenin refugee camp in northern West Bank. According to eyewitness accounts, a large number of Israeli military forces stormed the camp on Thursday morning. The attack triggered violent confrontations with local residents, during which Palestinians were killed. The victims were identified by Palestinian media as Tariq al-Damj, Siddiqui Zakarneh, and Atta Shibli. According to reports, before the confrontation broke out, Israeli snipers were positioned on the rooftops of buildings overlooking the camp. At least 10 people have also been injured there. Israeli forces also fired directly at an ambulance during the raid, and its medical staff reportedly survived death. Israeli forces have recently been conducting overnight raids and killings in the northern occupied West Bank, mainly in the cities of Jenin and Nablus. New groups of Palestinian resistance fighters have been formed there. The latest figures bring up the number of Palestinians killed by the Israeli forces since the beginning of the year to 216. At least 164 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank. Scores of Palestinians have also been killed in Israeli raids in the Gaza Strip.
Simply saying this, Israeli establishment, the military, the security apparatus, and the settlers have clear orders to kill. They kill Palestinians even in cases of suspicions. They are always quick to pull the trigger. Recently, almost all raids to the West Bank areas leave Palestinians either killed or injured, and none of the soldiers have been investigated to any of the crimes.
According to the United Nations, the number of Palestinians killed by Israel in the occupied West Bank this year is the highest in 16 years. Rights organizations say that Israel is conducting a shoot-to-kill policy against Palestinians.
Their main program is ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. And the second is to suppress any form of resistance of Palestinian people and to enhance settlements everywhere. So practically, Israel has all the interest in enhancing the oppression against Palestinians. And we've seen even certain escalation during election time because Israeli parties were using Palestinian blood to feed their election purposes.
The rising violence against Palestinians comes against the backdrop of Israel's defiance to be held accountable for its crimes. The Qatar state-funded broadcaster Al Jazeera has filed a lawsuit at the International Criminal Court, the ICC, over the killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Al Jazeera says it has new evidence showing that she was killed by Israeli forces.
Many have called for an investigation. Shireen's family who are here today have made their own request. The Palestinian Authority has provided a comprehensive body of evidence, and yet there's been complete silence from the Office of the Prosecutor on this case, on cases across the board, in fact, in the Palestine situation.
The veteran journalist was shot in the head, killed on May 11, while she was covering their raid in the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. At the time of her killing, the 51-year-old journalist was wearing easily recognizable press attire. Al Jazeera now says its legal team has conducted a full and detailed investigation into the case and has unearthed new evidence based on several eyewitness accounts and video footage that clearly shows that Abu Akleh and her colleagues were directly fired in a deliberate killing by Israeli forces.
While there is overwhelming evidence from multiple eyewitnesses, over a dozen of investigations by reputable news outlets and human rights organizations and the United Nations, that Shireen was targeted and killed by an Israeli soldier, my family still doesn't know who the person is that shot that deadly bullet and who was involved in the chain of command that allowed them to kill my aunt.
It says the claim by Israeli authorities that the Palestinian journalist was killed by mistake in an exchange of fire is, quote, completely unfounded. Multiple investigations by independent organizations and media outlets have already concluded that Abu Akleh was deliberately shot by Israeli forces.
This was a proposal that was floated with only in recent hours, only today, by Al Jazeera. So I don't know that it has been a topic of discussion. I don't know that it would be a topic of discussion unless we had representations from the ICC that they were going to take an opinion one way or another.
Well, I mean, she was an American citizen.
Of course.
So it's not like you have no interest in it
at all.
But you oppose it.
We oppose it in this case for the reasons that we've
The Israeli military, following a long denial, finally admitted in September that Abu Akleh might have accidentally been killed by Israeli fire directed towards suspects identified as armed Palestinian gunmen. The United States has said it's investigating the case, but has refused to publicly condemn Israel for the killing.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرض.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
The holy name of Ali has been written on the divine throne.
Khawarizmi has reported Abdullah ibn Mas'ud on the authority of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his progeny, as saying, When God created the universe and Adam and blew in him his spirit, Adam sneezed and began to praise Allah immediately. God said, My servant, now that you praise me, by my glory, were if not for the sake of two of my servants, I would never have created you. Adam said, O God, are those two worthy servants from my issue? God said, Yes. Now raise your hand and behold what you see. Adam opened his eyes towards heaven and saw an inscription reading, There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad, the Prophet of Mercy, is his messenger, and Ali is Allah's proof for the people. Whoever recognizes Ali is right, he is pure inwardly. And whoever denies his right will be deprived from my mercy and will suffer. I swear by my glory that whoever obeys Ali, I will give him a place in heaven, even if he is sinful, and by my glory, if anyone disobeys him, I will punish him with fire, even if he has obeyed me.
¶¶
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, dear friends, as we talk about the beautiful and totally brilliant persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, one of the things that we really want to talk about is this idea of zuhud, this idea of asceticism. Now, of course, we find in the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam that this zuhud is really an integral and very fundamental part of his life, and it is a fundamental part of his persona. We don't see any kind of extravagance or luxury in the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Now, of course, we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam has said to his companions that the amount of zuhud that Imam Ali has undertaken in his life, as he himself says, is not something that any regular person would be able to do. Of course, his station being his station and our station being our station. But of course, that can never be an excuse for us to be able to try to emulate as close as we can these behaviors and these lifestyles and these manners and the seerah and the sunnah of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So of course we find his life is full of zuhud, is full of asceticism. Now this asceticism sometimes we think means to wear torn clothes, to wear smelly clothes, to wear dirty clothes, to wear shoes that are broken, and to look like a pauper. When in reality this is not the truth. The truth is to not look like a pauper, and it is not to act like a pauper or a poor person. The purpose is primarily the detachment from worldly material things, right? We cannot be attached to these material things. We cannot be attached to worldly things, to wealth and power and clothes and shoes and, I don't know, cars and mansions and these kind of things. The attachment is primarily what is a problem. But on the next level, does that necessarily mean that if I'm not attached to a, multi-million dollar car, just because I'm not attached to it, does it mean that I can buy? Of course not. When we look at the traditions of the Messenger of Allah and we look at the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, no, we should have something that is not lavish, is not extravagant, and that is under the role model of individuals such as Imam Ali alayhi salam. So for example, the Messenger of Allah would ride a mule. Now, a mule in many instances is an animal that is not as expensive as a horse when looking at that time. It is not as expensive as a camel, and it is, even though it's a little bit better than a donkey, right? So we find that they're riding on a mule. And he used to say that he would also have a second person ride with him on this mule, right? So it's about a personality, it's about a persona. Imam Ali alayhi salam eating dry bread or his clothes having patches on them. Now, at the same time, there's another point that we want to make before we end the program. This doesn't mean that we should be actual poor people. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't work, we shouldn't acquire wealth, we shouldn't make wealth, we shouldn't go to work. No, these are not the things that are being said. The main thing that we're trying to get across and what we see in the persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is that despite having wealth, they spent their wealth on the way of Allah. And despite having wealth, they were never attached emotionally or spiritually to this wealth. And this is what ultimately led them to one of the highest levels of zuhud that humanity has seen ever in the history of humanity. A beautiful, profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, And at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم إن قلوب المخبتين إليك والها وسبل الراغبين إليك شارعا وعلى القاصدين
O Allah, verily the hearts of those who surrender to Thee are full of passionate love. The path of those who long for Thee is the straight, true road. The instructions given by those who lead on Thee are distinct and precise. The minds of those who are aware of Thy reality are filled with awe and reverence. The call of those who invite unto Thee is loud and clear, and the doors of approval are kept open for them. Whoso submits a supplication to Thee receives a favorable answer. Whoso turns repentant unto Thee gets acceptance and amnesty. Whoso bursts into tears in fear of Thy punishment obtains mercy. Whoso seeks redress from Thee finds the required assistance at his disposal. Whoso asks for Thy help procures the aid as a gift. Thy promise made with Thy servants is fulfilled. Whoso asks for pardon of his errors finds them reduced to nothing. Whoso does everything for Thy sake discovers that each and every deed has been preserved. The means of livelihood available to the created being come from Thee like a rainfall, and in addition, many recurring favors and bounties reach them in regular succession. The sin of those who ask for forgiveness are overlooked. The wants and needs of all that which has been created by Thee are properly satisfied. Those who put forward genuine demands get more than they ask for, one after the other, again and again. For the hungry, wholesome food is arranged. For the thirsty, clean water is available in abundance.
Now we invite you to listen to Brother Hassanain Rajabali.
That when a person of Bani Israel comes and says to him, your khilafah has been taken. The Prophet just died and they took your khilafah. Imam Ali alayhi salam mentions, he says, your forefathers before their feet had dried of salt water. When Musa went up to the mountains, you idolized a cow and you worshipped it. We Muslims are united in Tawheed. Our salah is intact. Our Quran is intact. Get away from me. Did he say, yes, join me. Yes, I want this. I want this power. I need this power. No. Any accusation is false. And once Imam Ali was stitching his shoes, there was no more room to stitch. And Salman comes to him and says, Amir al-Mu'mineen, tell me, give me some hidayah. He says,